Thank you, Fred. Well, in reading this chapter over the years, and I can't say I've read it every year. We don't typically read through the Bible every week, kind of give more concentration on certain books of the Bible, and then we move on, and then we might come across it every second or third year. But we're going through this chapter. I've always had question marks that have come to mind. And so the approach I'm going to use this morning or this evening is to look at the passage. I'm going to read through the passage, and then we have a series I provided Ray, a series of questions that came to mind. And some of those I look at them now, Ray, since I submitted this to you, I could have improved on, but this is whatever it is, it's done. So I'll try to answer these as I can. Let's look at a map that Ray has so kindly brought up here to show the area that we're dealing with. There it is. Joanne and I had the privilege in 1996 I taught over there and did some consulting. Believe it or not, at that time, the only cell phone that was available was Motorola. And there was a Christian manager at Motorola who said, we really need parts, cell phone parts. So we're going to buy a plant, the World War II plant in Tiberias, and we're going to name that plant Galilee Electronics, and we're going to build cellular phone parts there. And we're going to send a bunch of people that can maybe help these. What happened, this is shortly after the fall of the empire, you know, the Iron Curtain. And so a lot of East German or East European and Russian scientists went over there. And so that constituted most of our people that worked for me, or I should say that I consulted with. We had one Arab in the class from Nazareth, and then the others were all from, you know, either Russia or Eastern Europe. Well, the idea was of this vice president that maybe we can, you know, teach them how to, you know, make these cellular phone parts for us. But since they're all, you know, mostly a non-Christian, we could try to reach them with the gospel. So they brought over a bunch of Christian specialists, like the head of Honeywell up in Minneapolis was brought over as the R&D director. And we had actually one man from our church in Madison that went over, and he became the IE director. And so since that time, we had a chance at the end to, we didn't try to bring up the Lord during the class, but we had a chance afterwards, and we continued to pray for those men and that one woman there in Tiberias, which is up here, you know, here on the Sea of Galilee, up farther up here. But what you have here is a nice picture, and I never got down to it. I was taken around afterwards. We got down to Masada, which is about here. And we could look down and see that this was pretty, it was in the haze, so we couldn't make it out very well. But there's a lot of evidence of burnt area. There's lots of pitch down there and so on like that. I've seen show I used to give on Israel, and I have a picture of that burnt area in here. So I believe that there's no question about that this terrible thing which is going to come up in chapter 19 did take place. Next slide. Okay, we're into the chapter. It's chapter 18, and the way I'm going to approach this is is just read the verse and then comment on it and try to answer the question. Then the Lord appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre as he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day. My first question is, why does it mention only the Lord, who I believe is, as was said earlier, a Christophany? Well, I believe his personage, of course, is so far superior to his angelic assistants. I mean, he is the angel of the Lord. And so he's the one that's going to do almost all, if not all, of the talking with Abraham and with Sarah in this chapter. But another thing that comes to mind here, and that is, what is a terebinth tree? And Bible scholars are greatly divided over this. As you see, here we have the terebinth tree, but the NIV, well, first of all, what does terebinth mean? The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines it as a small European tree of the cashew family yielding turpentine. And I just don't believe that is a good translation of that. I mean, from the Hebrew. The NIV translated it as great trees. The RS, the Revised Standard Version used in England, the Young's Literal Concordance, and the Conversational Message translated as oaks. The New Living translates it as a oak grove. And interesting enough, if you have the old King James, if you're Oliver Vernon McGee, who only uses that, and in his presentation, it says it's the plain, P-L-A-I-N, of Mamre. Well, back in chapter 14, we read that Mamre was an Amorite, and they were allied with Abraham. Genesis 14:3 basically says that. Now remember, so he's using this ally or friend to park his company, which could number between 300 and 400 people beside the flocks and herds which he had there. So I think it was as was said in the New Living Translation, which Chuck Swindoll likes to use. It's a lot different from the earlier Living Bible. It's more accurate. But he calls it an oak grove. So I believe it was an extensive grove. And if it was anything like the oaks I have in my backyard, they have spreading branches, and they would be great in an Arab climate where there, you know, is little or if none rain. I think it was a good place for them to be. I think that eventually, Abraham goes down as far as Beersheba, but at least at this time he's here. So let's look at the next question. Thank you. We'll read down in the next verse here. So he lifted up his eyes and looked. Behold, three men were standing by him. And when they saw him, he ran from the door of the tent to meet them and bowed by himself to the ground. The word that confused me is, if they're standing by him, verse 2, why would he have to run from the tent door to meet them? I think the ESV, the English Standard Version, has that better, which says in front of. I think that's a better, so somewhere in front of him, who knows how much distance, he woke up. I think he was napping and he saw these men coming. Now, look at verse, why does Abraham only address the Lord? I honestly can't make a strong statement. He had Well, he had recently had two encounters with the Lord in chapters, recorded in chapters 12 and 17. So, you know, he knew the Lord. And again, the Lord being, you know, so much, I don't know what he looked, what that Christophany looked like, but it was clear that here was someone he was familiar with, and he could address his questions to him, or his pleading to him. Now notice verse 4. Do I have a question on that? I guess, these are the 4 and 5 that I have. No. Huh. Okay, there was, okay, maybe, I don't know. I have a question.
I didn't see one, Dave. I can go back to your.
I must have updated my, that's the question. Well, I guess it's just comments I have on 4 and 5.
Sure, I'm sorry about that.
No, I'm sorry. Abram's visitors were going to get the royal first-hand treatment. You know, it was a custom in the Middle East to eat with, eat before the door and to invite any stranger to share in that. Back in 1996, we were climbing the slopes from Jericho in a bus up to Jerusalem. And there was a lot of Bedouin encampments, tent encampments with a multitude of sheep around them. And we were told by our guest, or that was taking us around, not our guest, our host, he was saying that you just, if you get near them, they will latch on to you and they'll not let you go. Sometimes they'll insist not only on meal, but have you stay overnight with them. That still is a practice, a kindness that is practiced in the Middle East there. And but you recall the Lord in Luke 7, as recorded in Luke 7, 44. He took a Pharisee by the name of Simon to task. Simon had invited him over to his house. And at that time, a lady who had been in sin and was forgiven by the Lord, you know, did as Mary did later on in taking spices and pouring it on his feet and washing it with, or drying it with her hair. And what we have, I think, it was said in Luke 7:44, he failed to show the Lord this courtesy of even, you know, wiping his feet, the dust off his feet. And so anyway, in our story here, although these heavenly beings didn't require, you know, food to eat like we earthlings do, they were acquiesced and accepted Abraham's invitation. So going on in this chapter, we see Abraham is, could we have the next question? Maybe it was at 6. No, it's 7 and 8. I guess I have a question. Okay. Can I have the next question, please? I think that's 7 and 8, is it? Yeah, there was. So Abraham goes into the tent and he gives an order to make a very extensive meal. As far as the, notice he mentions 3 measures of fine meal needed and make cakes. From all I could, my study, it seemed like that what he, the extent of that, that you know, the what he's asking for here is to take a bushel of some sort of a wheat and make cakes out of bread or something like that out of it. So it was a big undertaking. Of course, they had a lot of servants, and I'm sure that, you know, as he did assign the dressing of a calf to another man, to one of his servants, he hastened to prepare it. Now, I have, you know, I work for a slaughtering company, and I saw too many animals slaughtered. But I slaughtered, but then dressed out. And I'll tell you this, that by the time they get the animal disassembled, you know, it takes a good chunk of time. And so the Lord and his two angelic assistants, you know, were patient enough to wait for this meal, because you couldn't pull this off in a short time. And I don't, I tried to contact my, I have a Christian a grandson who goes hunting. I tried to get a hold of him tonight. He's an engineer, and he wasn't home. I was going to find out what it takes to dress out a deer as a comparison of this. Anyway, these heavenly beings were willing to accept this kindness that they had. Okay, let's look at the next question. I guess that's what I, you know, I gave here. So he not only prepared that, but they took bread and milk and the calf which he had prepared and set it before him. And they sat under the tree as they ate. They must have had a picnic table, not really, but something to sit outside, something at a table to sit outside. Okay, next question. Okay. So in verse 9, they said to him, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" And so he said, "In the tent." And it's interesting that we have no indication that Sarah came out at this point in time. No indication at all. And the Lord then states this, it's a restatement of a wonderful blessing, except this time he gives a particular time when a baby is going to be born to Sarah. And we see at the, in parentheses in that verse 10, Sarah was listening in the tent door, which was behind him. So why didn't the Lord insist on telling her directly? Why did he give this message to Abraham to be conveyed to her? Well, that's an excellent question, because I don't know, very frankly. But the man was, you know, the head of the house. There are certain nationalities where the man, you know, is the one who meets with the guests. He's the host, meets with the guests. And the wife hardly comes out of the kitchen. Just going back and remembering our assembly we had in Cudahy, Wisconsin, there was a Armenian family that came, or at least the wife was Armenian. Which I can remember my mother, you know, when we went over as we were guests of theirs as a family. And my mother would say, Eva, come out and join us. But she insisted to be in the background and let Bud Skritzmeyer, he was her husband, she married and became Eva Skritzmeyer. So I shouldn't say, her maiden name was Vartanian. But she finally came out after, you know, a long time of, you know, discussion with just Bud alone. So maybe that was something characteristic of that time with, you know, the Jewish people. I don't know. But that's the only thing I can think of why he would, you know, tell it, you know, to Abraham. And then, of course, we realize that she overheard it, didn't she? So let's look at verse 11 there. We know that they're very old beyond having children. Then would you bring up the next question, Ray? Well, I guess even if you're going to give a message this important, you'd think that he would want to give it to her face to face. But He does not. And the second part of this question is, you know, let me read down and a little bit farther here. So what did Sarah do? You know, she laughed within herself and saying, I have grown old. Shall I have pleasure, my Lord, being also old? And the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? Now see, when you think she's addressing the Lord here, I have my pleasure, my Lord. She's referring to Abraham, not our Lord Jesus. And the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I bear a child since I am old? Well, and it goes on to say, is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. This is the first time that the Lord has given a definite time when the baby would be born. And why do you think that the Lord, didn't allow, why did the Lord judge Sarah for laughing and not Abraham? We saw Abraham, and let's look back at 17:7. 17:17, and God had said in verse 15 to Abraham, as for Sarah your wife, you shall not call her Sarai. I shouldn't read that right. Let me go back. As for Sarai your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. I will bless her and also give you a son by her. And then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? So what do we have here? We have a situation where Abraham did the same thing, but it was incredulous to him, but he didn't lack faith, I think, is the big difference here. And I think that's the reason that this happened. Well, let's go on in this chapter here, chapter 18, and look down. So let me just say, I don't think that Sarah was we shouldn't be so hard on her. I would think that, you know, we sometimes, well, firstly, when we first save, maybe feel we've gone too deep into sin to be saved. And then other times, I believe that, you know, believers who have been away from the Lord, we get into difficult situations, we kind of faint in them and just give up instead of believing that all things are possible for the Lord to even restore us. Okay, going on in this chapter. There's a question I keep asking. Who is Jehovah addressing or speaking with here? Let me just read down there. And Sarah did certainly have faith, but then she also had doubts, and I think that's what caused her to. So it was a laugh at maybe of joy at first that she was going to have the joy of having a baby of her own, not one that was kind of came about through giving her one of her servant girls away again to Abraham, but that she herself was going to have that joy of being pregnant and going a full 9 months. Okay, going on further, verse 16, then the men rose from there and looked towards Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on their way. I believe that where he was situated, where this Oaks of Mamre was on a some bluffs that overlook the plain where Sodom and Gomorrah and some other cities, just as wicked, were located. And so I think when it talks about them looking towards Sodom, they maybe just looked down from the bluffs where Abraham was. And I think from there was some sort of a path that led down to the plain, which I believe that were taken later by the angels. Okay. So here we have a situation where the Lord has already organized an investigative team to scout out the conditions in Sodom. And who is the Lord speaking to here? I think possibly to his two assistants, his two angelic assistants. And then he's having, you know, I wouldn't say he is having a second thought, because I think the Lord had this all in mind, that he was going to give Abraham a chance to negotiate or to plead for his family down there. But, and why was he going to do this? Because of Abraham's great faith. I remember he told me he was going to be the father of nations, as well as he being his friend. You know, our Lord is going to reveal what he's intending to do. You know, to judge, really, I would consider all those cities down there an evil nation. Remember how in Genesis, was it 13 or 14, they went to war, that whole group of, and they were defeated by another confederation of nations. And then Abraham and his 318 servants went after them and were able to rescue these folks from Sodom and these cities of the plain. Excuse me. Gotta still work out the bugs of this, trying it this way. I do thank again, Ray, for all your good work. Okay, so I think I've answered the question. Let's read down then from verse 20 and 21. For I have known him. Okay, he's talking about, he's got many good things to say about Abraham. You know, that he's going to be a father of great nations, and that he's going to walk, he's going to be an example, and he's going to actually, for his posterity. Okay, so it goes down, and the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that have come to me. And if not, I will know. Who is the outcry? I believe it was people in Sodom and also the visitors, just like the angels were, you know, attacked and, you know, were going to be sodomized. So I think it was just a very, very wicked city. You know, it wasn't their only sin. And I might want to point out to you some verses which state of other sins that they had committed. And let me see if I can find a reference on those. One is in Ezekiel. You might want to look at that. Ezekiel chapter 3, I think it is, in verse 49.
Doesn't have 49.
Oh. Oh boy. Well, I got there wrong. Sorry about that. Oh, yeah, I see.
Do you have a word that you
sorry,
could?
I'm sorry. It's Ezekiel 16:49. Please forgive me. Ezekiel 16:49. Reading from the New King James, and look, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. She and her daughter, and I don't know what her daughter refers to, had pride, fullness of food, and abundance of idleness. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. So it wasn't only the sin of sodomy that was their problem. You know, they just basically closed their eyes to those who are less fortunate. And then, of course, in Jude 7, we might as well, I'll look at that with you. Jude, of course, that is one chapter, verse 7. It talks about even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. You know, sadly, you know, we look at these towns and we think maybe they're the only ones that have practiced this evil. But just before Nebuchadnezzar invaded Jerusalem and took the bulk of inhabitants into captivity to Babylon, Jeremiah 23:14 states, and this is Jeremiah speaking, I have also seen also in the prophets of Jerusalem a horrible thing. They commit adultery and walk in lies. They strengthen also the hands of evildoers, that none doth return from his wickedness. They are all of them unto me as Sodom, and the inhabitants thereof as Gomorrah. Isn't it horrible to think that Jerusalem and maybe Judea itself got to such a low state just before, you know, the actual raising of the temple and the hauling off the bulk of the people into exile in Babylon. So, go on to the next question, please, if you wouldn't mind. I'll go back to Genesis 18 here. You know, here in verse 22, I have a question. Why did Abraham physically prevent or block the Lord from going further while the two angels proceeded down towards Sodom? Well, I think the answer, he's going to do some heavy negotiations, some serious negotiations with the Lord. And I think that is what he has in mind here, stood still before the Lord. As they're walking, you know, down this maybe start of this path, down the bluff, he kind of blocked the Lord. That's how I take it. And let me just see if I have the questions here beside the ones that you're showing up there. And let's see what we have. So we talked about the sins of the Sodomites, you know, what they were. And so what would we say about the next 22? I think I've answered that question. Could we have the next question here? I guess that was the question also. So next question, please. Okay, verse 24. So how is he going to do this? How is he going to approach this? And he's going to set up a, example of, you know, how many righteous there are. And so he, you know, he questions the Lord about, you know, sparing the place for those 50. And what does righteous mean here? I have to feel that this is not, necessarily a person that's righteous before God, but one who is not engaged in sodomy or maybe these other sins that are mentioned in Ezekiel of defrauding or holding back from the poor. I don't know. I mean, it could have been just righteous in every respect of the of their lives, but and why does Abraham start by mentioning only 50 righteous persons? Well, I think he has heard, maybe he has gone down into Sodom, but maybe the word has gotten up, the scuttlebutt has gotten up to him of the terrible goings on there are. And with 50, I think he's allowing for possibly the sons-in-law of Lot, and also maybe their parents, you know, thinking maybe those families are righteous. So I'm guessing that's maybe why he starts at 50. Of course, I may be all wrong on that. Would you have the next question, sir? Well, as we see that he, verse 25, I think he's trying to strengthen his case here by reminding the Lord of his being a just God. You know, he's showing highlighting the Lord's character before continuing his bargaining. And I think it's to have the Lord maybe look more sympathetically upon, the people that, are innocent. Let's go down a little further here then. So he starts so he calls him, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Isn't that interesting how that phrase is used by many? I've used it many, many times over the years. And it only occurs here. If there's no similar phrase, it's my knowledge in all scripture. Okay, let's go on to the next question. What does Abraham say to enhance or increase his bargaining power to even a greater degree? And I think it is here because now he compares himself with the Lord. And he knows how he expresses abject humility by declaring himself to be but dust and ashes. And I think the Lord certainly responds to a humble heart. And I would think that would increase his negotiation power, if you're going to call it that. Okay, the next question. This is a hard one. So he sounds like he starts out with 50, but then he goes to 45 here, five less than the 50. And then why does he jack up the incremental number to 10? Maybe thoughts come to him of reports that he has received that there really aren't that many down there that are living a righteous life, at least, abstaining from that awful, terrible practice of sodomy. So maybe he's being more realistic here. That's the only, I'm guessing that I have no, I read it and I prayed over it and I looked at some commentaries, but I didn't see anybody else who tackles this or tackled this question. Okay. No, but now I know, want to call your attention to verses 30 and 32. Abraham, now he's pleading, he's begging the Lord not to be angry, perhaps again to strengthen his, you know, his negotiation stand, or is it after that? Let me just see. If we see this in verses 30 and 30, we're getting down to the end of it. Now he has one more, no, he has several. He goes to 20 and then he goes to 10. And Lord, notice that it's very important to notice the Lord is, every time he says he would save, he would spare the city if there are that many righteous. And he does so for the sake of 10. And that's getting down pretty low now. We're getting down to that's Lot, his wife, and the two girls. But it still would have room for his sons-in-law down there. But he stops here. And so who's terminating the discussion? I don't know. It seems like the Lord is initiating his departure at this point in time. And my last question is in verse 33. We never read of the Lord entering Sodom as the two angels did. Oh, wait a second. Yeah, what did he do? Did he go into Sodom? Well, we don't read about him going into Sodom. We definitely read of the angels going there. So my guess is that he had seen enough. Maybe he got to the outskirts, didn't enter the city, but he had enough eyewitness proof that these people deserved a terrible judgment. We know the Lord came down once before, I believe, with his father, and that was, to view the Tower of Babel and the work of Nimrod there, and confusing their language. So he, on the spot at that time, took the step of confusing their language. I honestly believe that, he didn't have a bunch of, were assigned German language, and others Polish language, others Slav language. I believe that for a while, everybody had a different language. And then I think that people came together to, that maybe languages that were close, and they came up with the languages that the world has now. So I think that's all I have to say here on this chapter. Again, I apologize for the the bugs in it. We're just decided to try this out. Yes, I have this summary question. And this passage would encourage believers as well, as others. God affirms solemnly that he will fulfill his promises concerning salvation and all his blessings that pertain to life. And so it's really not a question. It's not a question. And despite opposition, suffering, and even death, he keeps his promises. My question that I really meant to have is, in our time, in the, let's say here in the 21st century, if God is going to take some strong action that will affect our family, or let's say our congregation, or our country, does he give an opportunity for righteous individuals to intercede on behalf of our country? And does it, would he actually take the judgment off the table? You know, if there is enough in the way of sincere coming before him and object, you know, humility and pleading that God would not do it. I'm, of course, God's not going to come down in a verb. I don't believe he's going to come down in a sense where we'll see him, you know, see him in a, as a Christophany or anything like that. But just the idea of what I'm saying, does God do that? Will he give us the opportunity, not go right to the judgment, but give godly believers the opportunity to plead for, you know, him not to take the awful step that he's planning? Will he actually take that off, you know, remove that from, you know, the verse that comes to mind is a verse in Second Chronicles, if my people who are called by my name shall humble themselves and pray and seek his face, and he will, I don't have it before me, but he'll come out and he'll heal their land. And we certainly pray that for our land right now, don't we? Well, I thank you for your kindness to listen to my stumbling thoughts tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave, for preparing these questions from that chapter. That was really an interesting approach, and it's piqued my interest to try to maybe study this a little bit further to know. But I appreciate your preparation and your knowledge of the scripture and also your experience in the land of Israel. What a great time that must have been, an interesting time 25 years ago in Israel.
Thank you.
And we're going to go back one day, aren't we?
Yeah, we like to.